But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Welcome to The Wealth Show. My name is Sophie Downs, and I'm joined today by Lewis Koch, Director of Private Clients at Charles Stanley. Lewis started his career at the firm 20 years ago and is therefore well placed to discuss our topic today, which is the changing nature of wealth management. Welcome to the podcast, Lewis.
Thank you.
Now, this episode is really born out of a prior conversation we had about how the role of the wealth manager is changing. And that's changing away from mere stock picking. So to recap for our listeners, from your perspective, how has the role of the wealth manager developed during your tenure in the industry?
It's changed massively. Part of that is just industry growing up and maturing. But a lot of it is client need, you know, as you would expect. So when I started in the early 2000s, it was all about investment selection. It was about stock selection, asset allocation to a lesser degree than it was now. And that was really your role. You were the person that made the money. And now it's much more sort of rounded. It's more about soft skills. It's about, can you solve these money problems? Not, can you pick stock X over stock Y? And the whole skill set that goes with that is something that we just didn't have 20 odd years ago.
Mm-hmm. What specific responsibilities might that look like? Maybe you didn't have when you first started.
So it is problem solving rather than investment finding. It's problem solving. So, for example, things like, how do I plan for the cost of retirement, or at what point do I give my kids some money and how do I tell them about it? How do they deal with not taking away the kids' motivation? That's quite a big one. If someone gets a big lifetime gift, it can kind of slightly demotivate them in terms of what they want to do. And as a parent, you don't want that to happen. So it's all those kind of things, which are still money questions. They're still wealth questions, but they are not stock A versus stock B, which is where we started.
I really want to dig into some of those issues in a bit more detail. I mean, how did we get to this point? What's sort of caused the need for these softer skills?
Life's more complicated, to be honest. That's it. Life is more complicated. You have an aging population. And then the third part of that is for the younger generation, as we probably know, we have high costs of housing. We have pension provision, which is nowhere near what it once was with final salary schemes. And you have high cost of childcare, which is a major expense for a lot of people. So you sort of got all of this coming together. You've got older generations that have made their wealth and are starting to plan how much of it they're going to need. And they also see the younger generations that they can see that they are going to need some help. So how much help do you give them? In what size? How do you plan for it? And it's money, you know, and the Brits are not very good at kind of talking about money, planning with money, divulging what you have. So there's a bit of a mountain to climb in terms of not just the physical act of moving money around or giving it, but it's the whole, how do you start the conversation about it and how do you use it properly? And do both generations have the kind of skill set they need to manage it properly. All of that has come out in certainly the last 10 years, but definitely has grown for the last 20.
Mm-hmm. So this is what people are talking about when they talk about this kind of sandwich generation. So it's those people with, you know, responsibilities both for the children and for their parents as well.
It is. The sandwich generation, though, in my experience, sometimes can go a bit of a step further in that I have this phrase called double dependence. So it's this generation where they've got parents and the kids that they are sort of financially involved with. The complication for that sandwich generation, though, is that they're trying to do everything. They're trying to look after parents' affairs and potentially care fees, things like that. They're also trying to make sure the kids don't have too much debt and hopefully come out of university or education, whatever, with some kind of good start. But they're also trying to provide for their own retirement. You know, some of them will have final salary pension, for example, but a lot won't. So they're trying to do everything. And it's not just money, it's time as well. They're trying to divide their time. Hopefully they're at their peak career earnings at that sort of point. So they don't necessarily want to give up the career motivation and momentum. But then they need time to figure out the financial impact of all of that. And trying to balance that is a real challenge. So that's where they will then hopefully turn to their advisors and say, what can I do about this? And as one of the great things about this job is that you get to see common problems with common, you know, people in different age groups. So if you've solved that problem for one person, you can probably use a variation of that to solve the problem for another. And that can be incredibly useful for people.
And are those dual responsibilities having a material impact on the amount that's going into pensions?
Yeah, it does make a bit of difference. It does. There's also, I think over the last kind of couple of budgets, there's been a bit of scepticism about the use of pensions. You know, will the rules change by the time I get there, basically? There's also quite a bit of degree of scepticism from the younger generation around whether the state pension will be there or whether it will be means tested away. So the sort of the automatic assumption that it will be there and don't worry, because that will be my minimum standard. The young generation tend not to have that. And they will communicate that up the chain to the older generations. So you can see how all of that comes together to make quite a complicated picture. And even people who are on paper very wealthy worry about it, because these bills can be enormous. You know, if you're trying to support your kids to get through uni without debt or help them on the housing ladder, and then you're trying to help someone with your parents as well. In the UK, we have quite a bit of high tax rates, so you take that into account. So all of a sudden, you've got all of these layers, and people are trying to reconcile it and essentially figure out, am I on the right path or not? And it can be incredibly useful for someone to say, yes, don't worry, it's fine. Or actually to say, do you know, have you thought about this? And other people might be doing X. And the value of that advice is far more than just picking stock X over stock Y.
Mm-hmm. I think we have to touch on, you know, talking about pensions is the successive changes we've seen over the last two budgets.
Yeah.
How has that factored into client conversations? And is that a level of unease there that you're seeing?
Definitely. Yeah. I think the change to inheritance tax and pensions was something that a lot of clients really kind of thought quite long and hard about. And it became, the inheritance tax rules were so stable for so long that it became quite a core part of people's planning. So when you take that away, and especially given the tax rates that would be charged, it makes a meaningful difference. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So day to day, what are you hearing from the sandwich generation? What are their biggest concerns?
Biggest concern is, am I getting the balance right? And am I getting am I supporting every generation to the best of my ability, basically? So that is everything from long-term planning for the kids. You know, you're trying to assume what might their ability to save be, what might their ability to earn be. Is there any assistance I can give them now? Then looking at the parents. So how do you ideally use the parents' own capital to pay for their own care and needs? Sometimes there is a temptation to sort of be the hero and to bail everyone out, which is fine. That's a very noble thing to do. But it tends to be that then you yourself don't have any money left. So it doesn't work. Again, the balance is out. So it's using the parents' capital to pay for the parents' needs, operating under a power of attorney, all of those kind of things. And then at the end of it, also thinking, what does my retirement look like? Yeah, am I going to carry on working until I'm 70? A lot of people want to retire mid-50s, but actually is that achievable with all these other things? That's a real kind of challenging question. You know, I have some clients that want to retire on a very high income. And when you work through the numbers, you think, well, you can't retire early and on a high income. You can sort of have one of those things, but not both of those things. But the inverse is also true. You know, sometimes people have worried about this for so long, they've squirreled away so much money and hopefully invested it well, that actually you can sort of give them a bit of a sort of pat on the shoulder effectively and say, it's okay. Like, I understand your numbers and it will be fine. And they take a great deal of comfort from that, from a third party saying that it's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested to see how this intergenerational wealth transfer plays into this cohort. I mean, I've got a statistic here, which is that baby boomers are expected to transfer $5.5 trillion over the next two decades. So I think a common misconception is that when we talk about this wealth transfer, we're talking about parents to their Gen Z children, when actually we're referring to these baby boomers sending over to this middle generation. Is that correct?
It varies. So one thing, there's a few different ways of looking at this. So the most conventional way is just down one generation. What a lot of people now do is they call a give and skip, is what I call it. So they might make, say, lifetime gifts to the next generation down, and then in their will, they cut that generation out and actually skip to the next generation, or sometimes the other way around. But that happens quite a lot. You know, you can be quite inventive with your planning. Obviously, it depends on size and nature of what you have. But definitely there's a lot of opportunity there to do that. But it's not quite the conventional, you know, you inherit from your parents, you pay inheritance tax perhaps, and then, you know, at some point down the line, the whole process repeats. I think the whole professional services industry has come along a long way in terms of how it looks at that, how you can plan for it, and just the assets people have.
Mm-hmm. And as you briefly touched on earlier, you know, this can cause, you know, impacts behaviourally on individuals. I mean, we hear a lot about the wealth transfer being an opportunity for firms, but less about how this might impact clients on that kind of level. So if clients are transferring wealth earlier than ever before, what challenges might this throw up for recipients?
So a lot of it can be how they use it. So some want to use it straight away. Some are almost kind of scared of it because they don't want to make a bad decision. That comes up quite a bit. We have the prenup debate. So sometimes parents want to give to their kids, but there is this sort of niggling doubt about sort of partners and so on. So sometimes I get drafted in to have the prenup chat, which is always quite good fun. That's a test of my diplomacy skills and really how well you know your client. But yeah, and then it's the final part of it is planning. So yes, receiving money is great, but what are you going to do with it? I mean, so I had a chat with a client earlier this week. He's going to give his son a fairly large lifetime gift. The idea of that is that the son is going to buy a house and then he'll have a little bit of money left over. Fantastic gift to give your 20-something son. My conversation with the son was, okay, so he's very switched on. He's finished his study. He's now got a good job. My pitch to him was, you've got this head start in life. Now, don't throw it away, basically. So what my pitch to him was, what you were planning to spend on rent or a mortgage payment, invest it. Regular subs, even if it's, you know, just an ISA subscription, something like that, could be a pension, maybe, depends on the planning. But what you were going to spend anyway on debt service, invest it, because you want to compound that lifetime legacy that you've been given, rather than just kind of have a bit of an easy life. I have a client who's done a lot of lifetime gifting, and his kind of motto with this is, it's early compounding. It's not a kind of decade off. That's the idea. So if they can do that, it's a phenomenal start to their life.
I'm curious. I think this, you know, these are what we're talking about is incredibly nuanced situations and a blend of practical advice, but also verging into the sociological, psychological. How does this impact how you're speaking to clients now, or how you might approach situations?
So you've kind of gone from purely investment selection to exactly as you say, it's kind of psychology. A lot of it is soft skills, it's emotional intelligence. So a number of years ago, I had this kind of realization that the reason that clients use me is because I am a problem solver for their money challenges. So when you think about problem solving, then you kind of come up with a lot of different answers to these questions. And a lot of it is psychological. It's how people think about their money. What is it they're worrying about? Have they got the right kind of values in place to make the most of what they have? And families, you know, money can be a real divider in families. And for most people, at the core of what they want to do is they want to have a nice life for them and their family. And if you have all the money, but nobody talks to each other, that's not really going to be much fun. You know, a lot of families would rather have no money and everybody talks to each other. So to try and get to that kind of utopian middle ground, you have to get people talking about money. And you have to know what the sort of triggers are, what the problems are, where people's sensitivities are. And that requires a lot of soft skills. Basically, that's it. So a completely different skill set to what we would have had 20 years ago. But I think the value of that is much higher than just the stock selection alone.
Do you think wealth managers across the industry are equipped well enough to kind of deal with these softer situations?
I think the wealth management population as a whole has come a long way. Some are at the sort of pointy end of the stick, if you like, and have really got it. Others maybe are a bit earlier on the journey, and they're still very much kind of, I must make these numbers go up, which is fine, but it's kind of half the job. I think it will get there, though. You know, you're starting to see in the industry now a lot of consolidation. You're seeing some of the large banks come into financial advice again, which they've not done for quite some time. You have some very well-funded competition because the UK market is large and it's potentially very commercially lucrative if you get it right. So the competition is upping their game. And it's this soft skills type of work that you can't really get an AI robo-advice bot to tell you how to talk to your daughter about a prenup, but it can put together an asset allocation for you. You know, that's kind of where you're at. So you need to offer people something that they are willing and they want a person to sit there and give them dedicated advice on. And this stuff, you can't really get this stuff wrong, you know, so it's incredibly valuable to people and it's quite hard to figure out. So actually, once you've done it several times, you've seen what works, you've seen what hasn't. You know, I've seen my fair share of families that have been torn apart by money, and I've seen some exceptional examples where people have got it so right. It's unbelievable. So all you're doing is sharing the combined depth of that knowledge, but it's very valuable to people because they're only going to do it once. I've seen it done 100 times. They're only doing it once, so they've got to get it right.
What do you think firms can do to ensure that those skills that we're talking about are there with their wealth managers?
I think there's a lot to be done on empathy, on emotional intelligence, on understanding the different generations, how they look at things. You know, every generation looks at the world around them differently. But even things like pensions and housing and childcare, certainly for the younger generation, that is a major issue. The role of AI in the certainly the junior job roles, is it going to take my job? That's legitimately something that people worry about in the younger generation. But for the older generation, sometimes there's this kind of assumption that, oh, it'll be fine, don't worry about it. But it's easy for them to say that because it doesn't affect them. So you've got to kind of understand, put yourself in their shoes, basically, which sounds simple, but is quite difficult to do because we are, as a population of people, we like numbers. That's why we do this job. So you've got to kind of, numbers don't need empathy. But actually, when you deal with people, it's kind of 50-50. You need a good handle on numbers, but you need a good handle on people.
So we're talking a lot about how the demands of the job have changed, but also the way, I suppose, in which people can actually access the wealth managers is very different, particularly with the rise of influence, social media, etc. You yourself are very active on LinkedIn. I'm sure a lot of our listeners would have seen some of your videos on the app. How has the platform helped or changed the way you work?
It's been tremendous. It's been I'm one of these people that's been on LinkedIn for a very long time, but I didn't really start properly using it until 2020. So what I discovered, like all of us in 2020, was that I couldn't go anywhere. So I couldn't host a seminar or go and do a networking breakfast or anything like that. So how was I going to talk to people? You know, I still want to build a business, and get out there and talk to people. So LinkedIn was the one of the only options available to me. So I started just, you know, pushing the boundaries a bit of what you can do, because something that I've been aware of for a long time is that in wealth management, certainly at the high net worth end, people buy the name of the business undoubtedly, but they also buy the person. And that's a lot of what we are delivering, is person to person advice. And LinkedIn is actually a great way to show that. Because what they can do, you know, people will go on LinkedIn and they'll see me, the way I talk, the consistency that I'm basically saying the same stuff. And that goes an awful long way. It's as good as the sort of corporate brochure wear is and things like that. Everyone has that. So it's not really, you can't really stand out. And you can't also convey to people that essentially we're nice people and we'll look after you. But if they constantly see your LinkedIn videos, I'm sure people do on that, they just build up a bit of a rapport. You know, can I get along with this person? And above all else, do I trust your judgment? That's really what they're buying, is kind of your judgment. And if they've seen you time and time and time again, not just when kind of markets are easy and everything's rosy, but also when times are hard, you can't just disappear. And you have to keep kind of giving useful help to people. And it just helps build your reputation. But it's something that you can't really do with a kind of corporate gloss. It has to be the person that does
personal.
It. Personal. Yeah, exactly. It's that personal connection.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the opportunity on LinkedIn is obvious. But it's interesting to me because I think it seems like the industry is in a bit of a transitionary stage where most people do have it, they have an account on LinkedIn, but we're still using it very differently. How do you anticipate this playing out? Will LinkedIn become the sort of go-to for driving business and securing new clients going forward, do you think?
I think so. So how I use LinkedIn, people tend to think I use it as a sort of a lead magnet, if you like. You know, people see me on LinkedIn, send me a message and sign up as a client. If it were that easy, it would be great. But actually they don't. People a lot of the time use it for sort of validation. So they will hear my name through word of mouth or whatever it may be, some kind of referral. That's still very important. But then what people will do when they hear your name is put it into Google. Other search engines are available. First thing that comes up is LinkedIn. So then they can start doing that initial, what you would do on your first meeting, you know, can I get along with this person? Do they understand me? Well, they've done it because they've spent half an hour looking at my LinkedIn stuff for their sins. So that can be really quite useful for them. How that works as an industry, I don't think the industry has grasped it just yet, which is fine. They can take all the time they like. So I'll just live in this period of time for ages. But it's incredibly useful. You do have to be careful because it's social media and you're kind of talking to people about their money. Yeah, so there is a massive difference between what I do on LinkedIn is essentially talk about the problems that I'm seeing people have with money. That's what I'm talking about. What I'm not doing is what you see the kind of influencer type people doing, sort of pushing a particular type of investment or type of strategy. Or just kind of saying, oh, it's all easy. All you've got to do is A, B, and C. That's not wealth management. And that's not what I'm trying to do. So I think sometimes people in the industry are a bit scared of social media, but I think it's that, rightly, they're scared of, because that you can get into a whole world of pain with that. Just communicating how you are helping people without giving the actual answers, I think actually is incredibly valuable, because people can see what's the purpose of you? Why are you in a job? And they can look at your content on LinkedIn and think, oh, okay, I get that. I can see how that would work.
There is a fine line, I think, so definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, so we've discussed a host of changes that you've seen during your experience in the industry. Does that give you any sense of how things might change going forward, or what kind of conversations you might need to be having more?
Good question. Yes, it does. So I think there will be more conversations around more complex problems. Basically since the financial crisis, we've had markets that, with a few notable wobbles, albeit they've pretty much gone up without fail. The way in which they've gone up is you buy equities and you buy American equities, and that's pretty much it. I don't think that is going to carry on in the next kind of 10, 15 plus years. So making money is going to be harder. That wealth transfer is going to accelerate just because aging demographics. And you've got a lot of people who want a lot of different things. You know, in the last week or so, I've spoken to someone who's in their 80s and is only now just kind of joining the lifetime gifting thing, and they may have missed the bandwagon on that. I've also got someone who's in their 50s who wants to just retire immediately, live on a very, very generous income, and then trying to figure out how to do it. I've got a younger client who's just sold an app and then has come into lots of money. So there's all these kind of things, and people are just trying to figure out answers to complicated problems. But the world is not getting simpler, it's getting more complicated. And whilst certainly the technology we have now makes some of those answers easier, it doesn't give you all of the answers. And there is tremendous amount of value in having a person validate what you're looking at, or challenge you and give you some other ideas. Because certainly when you get to the larger figures, the risk of getting it wrong far outweighs the fee you're going to pay someone. And I think most people do kind of realize that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now you're going to have to humor me, Lewis, as this is the first podcast we're filming in 2026. So I had to put a planning question in there. But what conversations are you having with clients going into 2026? What should they be looking out for this year?
So 2026 has got off to an interesting start. It's been interesting early period. So there's lots about geopolitics. There's lots about the US in particular, where the US is going. As I mentioned, we've had this period of sort of US exceptionalism since 2009, basically. Will it continue? You know, is that the right way to allocate my money? So that is definitely coming up. The one question from last year, which I thought may carry on, is around the UK and our taxation changes. That actually isn't coming up so much. It is much more about geopolitics and what is the next 10 years going to look like. I think going into previous years, you've had a rough idea that this year will probably look like last year with a couple of little changes. This time round, maybe it won't. You know, and how do I, it depends on who you talk to. Some clients are saying, how do I position for that defensively to preserve what I have? But quite a lot of clients actually are saying, okay, well, a new world order or a new direction, if that's what we have, how do I profit from it? You know, if you were early in the right call after, say, the financial crisis, you've made an extraordinary amount of money for a very long time. So how do I position for that? And that's a tough question to answer, but it's coming up quite a bit.
How do you answer that without a crystal ball?
Well, without the crystal ball, I say I'll call them back. So the answer to that is, I think you go back to basics. So if you, let's say you have a client who is able to take a reasonable amount of risk. My background is equities. You know, it's very much a kind of Charles Stanley stockbroking heritage. And we are very active investors. So look at where the value is, not so much what's gone up recently, but where is the value? Yeah, we know over a long period of time, one, that most of the gains in markets come from a very small number of positions. And two, valuation does matter. Now, over the last kind of 5, 6, 7 years, you could argue maybe it doesn't anymore. I'm not quite so sure I'm there. But I think actually for the active, people willing to take an active stance with their capital allocation, I think this year looks more interesting than it has in the last 5, certainly.
I think that's quite a positive note to end it on. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
That's all we have time for today. We'll see you next week.
But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crown queen waves from the Belfry.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.